Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Steve Jobs is dead. It's news around the world today, remarkably big news. We have watched this man with fascination for decades as he made the computer revolution thrilling, as he innovated with a singular aesthetic, discipline, vision, as he battled cancer since 2004, and as he took the stage, gaunt but always a force, and tossed off digital miracles almost casually, the iPhone, the iPad, what swan songs. This hour on Point, the life and tremendous legacy of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs. You can join the conversation. Why have we paid as much attention to Steve Jobs as we have? How did he grab us? And what do we need to hang on to here from Steve Jobs for American innovation? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's the voice of Jobs himself. He died yesterday at 56. He was CEO into August. At it that late in the game, here he was at the 2008 Macworld Conference giving the keynote address.
Today, Time Capsule, companion product to Time Machine. Keep our data safe and backed up. Software upgrades for both the iPhone and the iPod Touch, iTunes movie rentals, and a completely reinvented Apple TV where you can order movies right on your widescreen TV. Unbelievable. And the MacBook Air. All of this in the first 2 weeks. And we got 50 more weeks to go. So we're pretty excited.
The force, the focus, the sort of crackle of energy in the air when Steve Jobs stood up and he did it time and time and time again. A couple of years ago, I spoke with Apple's co-founder, Steve Wozniak. It was he and Steve Jobs in that garage in California, 1976. Here was Steve's partner then. A couple of years ago, looking back, saying that Steve Jobs was always the engineering brain behind Apple.
Steve always had inspirations for bigger, greater things in life. You know, the Shakespeare, Einstein, Isaac Newton type things. He wanted to, you know, and he always had ideas to have a company and take, you know, one of these big, big companies in the world. So he would come up with the idea to see a product and say, let's sell it.
Let's sell it. Steve Wozniak right here talking with me just a couple of years back about his one-time partner, Steve Jobs, dead yesterday at 56. And the meme around the world today, you may have seen it on Twitter already, three apples have changed the world. Eve's, Sir Isaac Newton's, and the apple of Steve Jobs. Later this hour, we will hear from Steve Jobs himself from his remarkable 2005 commencement address at Stanford University. But first, joining me from San Francisco is Leander Caney, editor and publisher of the blog cultofmac.com and author of three books on Steve Jobs and Apple, The Cult of Mac, Cult of iPod, and Inside Steve's Brain. Leander, thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure, you're welcome, Tom.
And here in the studio with me, the great Nancy Kane, historian and professor at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thank you so much for coming in.
A pleasure, Tom.
Leander, I mean, everybody has their own definition, their own way of putting it, but what was it about this one man that has left such an imprint on so many people, that has so many people thinking today about the significance of his life and his passing? What is it? What was it?
Well, he was the singular innovator of the technology industry. Everything that's been happening in the consumer space and the technology industry really was set by him. And if, you know, people weren't using Macs, they were using Mac knockoffs, you know, the products that people like Microsoft copied. And he was such an innovator. It began, you know, his vision with Steve Wozniak back in the late 70s was to build the first personal computer for ordinary consumers. And so he wanted something that was easy to use, something you could just pull out of the box and just plug in straight away and start using. And this is a time when PCs were sold in kits and you had to solder them yourself on a workshop table, or they were sold to huge corporations and they filled entire rooms and they took a team of people to operate. So the same vision, you know, is what has driven him for the last 30 years, to make easy-to-use, simple technology for ordinary people. And you know, it's been an incredible run because it's had so many ups and downs, and yet he's remained true to that. and has been so innovative.
Nancy Kane, it still has a strange feeling to be speaking of Steve Jobs in the past tense, even though we've all known he struggled with pancreatic cancer and then the liver transplant for a long time. Very private about it, but that much was known. And still, to speak of him in the past tense is an odd feeling as we talk today. Where do you think he's going to land? I know it's early, but where does he land in the pantheon of American innovators, American business leaders, American technology innovators? How do you see this man's kind of standing?
Oh, I think he lands right at the top with, you know, a small number of great entrepreneurs in American history.
Is this Henry Ford territory?
It's Henry Ford territory, and I think to use a lesser-known comparison, it's Alexander Graham Bell territory. Men that actually, by virtue of what they saw in terms of a big vision, created products and ancillary services that both increased individual freedom and possibility. Think of the automobile or the telephone, or the iPad or the iPhone. At the same time that they increased our connection to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this unique set of gifts that came out of these men's vision, and they really changed not just the way we lived our lives materially, but also our sense of our world and our place in it. And they understood that. They didn't just do it accidentally. They understood it, and they worked from that kind of animating vision and passion, you know, in a palpable way. So we're mourning. We're grieving for that, and that vision and that and what he gave us out of that vision.
Leander Caney, you wrote the book Inside Steve's Brain. We heard his partner, one-time partner Steve Wozniak, saying earlier, you know, this was the Shakespeare, Einstein, Isaac Newton kind of mind. How did Steve Jobs see his own passion, his own, I don't know, role on this earth?
He hasn't really broached it. You know, he hasn't... He seems to be quite a humble man, you know, for an egomaniac. That's kind of a surprising thing to say. He's never
famously no shortage of ego here. I mean, it's not as though he saw the vision of his life's work as a small thing.
Yeah, right, totally. But you know, he never compared himself to Napoleon or Caesar or any other great historical figure. I mean, God forbid. You know, it's hard to say. I always think what was interesting about him is that he had so many ups and downs, and that, in fact, his career really was considered a failure just until the last few years. You know, when he left Apple, when he was looking at Next, and after leaving Apple in 85, you know, that was considered a huge failure. Toy Story was sort of seen as John Lasseter's baby and not really very much to do with Jobs. And the iPod, which is the company that really transformed Apple recently, was seen as a one-hit wonder. It wasn't until the iPhone and the iPad came out that people started to realize that, you know, that there is some incredible magic here, that, you know, that he's really doing something right. And so, you know, for most of his career, I think he was written off. He was described as a slick marketer, as nothing but a bit of a weasel, a slick talker, but nobody with any technology chops.
Boy, he sure talked big, though, right from early on. I mean, this is all the way back, 1983, at a keynote address, Steve Jobs here, before the unveiling of his famous 1984 advertisements, TV advertisement, that cast Apple as a kind of lone force rebelling against a 1984 Orwellian society then dominated by IBM. Here the... Wow, the scale of the ambition, the vision of Steve Jobs.
IBM wants it all and is aiming its guns on its last obstacle to industry control, Apple. Will Big Blue dominate the entire computer industry? The entire information age? Was George Orwell right about 1984?
I mean, Nancy Kane, he's got the chutzpah to put himself right on the ramparts, frame it in just those ways. Freedom! And it's Steve Jobs.
And, you know, he believed it. This was more than just a great advertising frame ginned up by Shiat Day, which it was that. But it was much more. From the beginning, he talked about this very candidly, an uncharacteristically open moment with Rolling Stone almost 2 decades ago when he said, look, these machines are instruments of revolution. We're going to democratize how information is disseminated, and that's going to democratize all kinds of markets, not just commerce, but the marketplace of ideas, the marketplace of public policy. Think about Arab Spring. Think about Occupy Wall Street. Think about Twitter. This man saw something long ago, right, that came to be true. So that advertisement was both a representation of what I think was fueling his own drive and his lust for power, and fueling the relentlessness and the persistence that Leander is talking about in this career marked by a roller coaster of ups and downs.
And the wild thing is, on top of all that, he wanted it to be beautiful. And then, and it was, and then the personal story, reading Hiawatha Bray in the Boston Globe this morning. I mean, he was born in San Francisco, February 1955, to a Syrian immigrant. His biological father, Abdul Fattah John Jandali from Syria, and Joanne Scheibel, both graduate students at University of Wisconsin in Madison, gave an interview last August. Jandali, his biological father, now vice president of a casino in Reno, Nevada, says that they gave him up for adoption because her father would not allow him to marry the mother of this child. A couple of months after the baby was adopted by Paul Jobs, a machinist, Clara Jobs, an accountant, that father died. She married Jandali, the Syrian immigrant. They had another child, Mona Simpson, now a novelist in Santa Monica. Steve Jobs didn't meet his biological sister for more than 30 years. But here we have, you know, thank you, Syrian immigrant Abdul Fattah John Jandali, even though you couldn't raise Steve Jobs, thanks to the adopted parents who did, and this remarkable man. At the end of this hour, we're going to hear Steve Jobs himself in a long excerpt of his incredible commencement speech, 2005 at Stanford University, where he talks about facing death, what life means once you've looked at death, what life means, period, our opportunity, our moment to create, to leave a legacy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. We're talking this hour about the life and tremendous legacy of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, dead at 56 yesterday, but so alive in that lifetime to at the frontiers of great innovation. With me this hour, Nancy Kane, historian and professor at Harvard Business School, focuses there on entrepreneurial leadership. Here it was. Leander Caney is with us from San Francisco, right there in Steve Jobs' backyard, editor and publisher of the Apple-centric blog cultofmac.com, author of lots of books on Apple, Mac, and Steve Jobs, including Inside Steve's Brain, former managing editor at Wired magazine. Here's Jobs, Steve Jobs, Macworld 2007. He's unveiling the iPhone there. That recently, it wasn't around. Kind of hard to believe now. But first, he was teasing the crowd in his way, saying Apple was introducing not one, but three new devices.
An iPod, a phone, and an internet communicator. An iPod, a phone. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
An internet communicator, and you put it in the palm of your hand or millions of hands out there. You hear the excitement, the fun in it right there. Early this morning in New York City, Hans Mai waited in line outside an Apple store for a new iPhone. Like a lot of other people, knows about that speech at Stanford, Steve Jobs kind of spilling his guts there. He spoke to AP about Steve Jobs outside an Apple store.
The speech he gave at Stanford, it's so inspiring. He talks about his setbacks being forced out of Apple and how instead of letting that get him down, he used that to move forward in so many ways in his life.
There were setbacks aplenty. We'll talk about them. We'll hear from Lev Grossman of Time Magazine in just a moment, but a couple of calls first. Nashville, Gary, thanks for calling, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I worked for Apple for about 11 years. Some of that time, Steve was at the helm, and some of the time he was not.
Mm-hmm.
But the two things I take away and really have impacted my own career is his drive for perfection. There are all sorts of apocryphal stories about rejecting a design because he didn't like the shape of a head on a screw in industrial design. And good enough wasn't good enough for Steve. He wanted it perfect. And that can be very harsh, I guess, at times. But the result is just undeniable. The beauty of the industrial design and of the user interface design as well.
Gary, when you say harsh, what do you mean? That you could feel the lash of Steve Jobs when it wasn't up to his snuff? Good enough was not enough?
Yeah, I mean, you would put your what you thought were your best efforts into something and then discover that it wasn't yet good enough. And you needed to go back to the drawing board and do it again. And he was always right, at least as far as I've I've ever experienced or heard.
Did people moan and groan and suffer under that? Or did they, you know, grow and appreciate it, or both? How did it feel?
Yeah, both. Both. Sometimes it was, oh, no. And then sometimes it was like, damn, he's right. So it was a very mixed experience, but it always resulted in better products.
You were there 11 years. Do you think Apple can stay on that high plane without Steve Jobs at the helm?
I think time will tell, but I'm very hopeful. Tim Cook, Jonathan Ivey, they got a great team who have really institutionalized the culture of innovation and have institutionalized this drive to get it right. And I'm very, very hopeful for the future of the company. I think his legacy will in fact live on.
Gary, I appreciate your call very much. An Apple veteran speaking to us there from Nashville, Tennessee. Lev Grossman joins us right now from New York, senior writer at Time Magazine, blogs for Time Magazine's Techland. His cover story on Steve Jobs will be out tomorrow. Lev, thanks very much. Welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back.
Can you institutionalize the cult of innovation that Steve Jobs came to personify? Can you do it in Apple? Can we do it in this country? How big a deal? How big an asset? How important is it?
Well, that's the contradiction right there, isn't it? Institutionalizing innovation. Institutions are static, and innovation is fluid and dynamic. Historically, almost nobody's done it. Nobody remains sharp and alert to the possibilities of change the way Steve Jobs did. Not Microsoft, not Google. Those companies have tried and they failed.
How do you stack him up as a business leader, a technology leader, an innovator? Where do you put Steve Jobs, Lev?
Well, he's a fascinating figure, just full of contradictions, because he was an innovator, but not in the ordinary way.
Mm-hmm.
He did not tend to invent things. He did not invent the tablet computer. He did not invent the digital music player. He did not invent the GUI, the famous graphical user interface
right.
of the Macintosh. Those things came from other places. But he recognized the power that they had. He looked at what everybody had, and only he saw the potential that lay in these innovations. And he wasn't an inventor so much as a recognizer. He recognized the power of these things, and he executed on them the way nobody else could. It's astonishing, and there isn't an achievement comparable in the annals of business or technology that I can think of.
Nancy Kane, not directly an inventor. In many ways, that's true, but he took what was there, what was emerging, and he made it so beautiful, so popular, sort of transcendently expressed. Is that, I don't know, is that, how important a role is that in the sort of new, America's trying to find its footing in this global economy. Is that what we've got to do? Invent and figure out how to make it wildly amazing?
Absolutely. I mean, Steve Jobs from the get-go, and he talked about a little bit about this in the Stanford speech, connected all these dots, right? The GUI, mm-hmm. the MP3 player, the possibility of the creative destruction in music distribution as he invented iTunes. He connected all these dots, and then he said, at each stage, how do we drive a truck through the hole in the marketplace, which is that most technology usage is functional, but not appealing, not energizing, mm-hmm. not beautiful, mm-hmm. not intuitive. It's harsh and hard and full of, like, you know, QDOS commands.
Clunky
and very frustrating. And he created products that energize people, that they intuitively understand. And he did it in a way that he avoided price competition. So think about how powerful that would be from a macroeconomic standpoint. You marry functionality, beauty, appeal.
And have a kind, one-of-a-kind sort of product people will pay.
That people will pay for, and that doesn't need to go on sale, and that marries the best of American marketing ingenuity with our own innate innovation and ingenuity to power a whole range of industries and avoid the kind of race-to-the-bottom price competition that is so much a part of a global economy.
Yeah, we'll look more at that. Leander Caney, he was not universally loved in the computer community, partly for exactly those things. He would smooth out the technology and seal it up. You couldn't just go in there and play, go geeking around on a lot of Apple products. They were a set piece, Leander.
Right, absolutely. And, of course, it goes, it's contrary to the sort of techno-libertarian streak in the technology community. I mean, alpha geeks want to be able to tinker with their hardware, and the whole point of Jobs was that it was integrated. And if you started tinkering with it, you would break that integration. He was always aiming at people who didn't want to be their own system administrators, people who didn't want to sit down and spend hours fixing the machine and figuring out how it works and customizing it. He was always aiming for devices that could be plugged in and would work seamlessly with each other. And I think it's actually been, you know, it's been astonishingly successful. This is why Apple's products are often so beloved, because you can plug an iPod into your machine. It'll suck all the songs off. You buy a song online, and it'll show up on your iPod seamlessly. And that goes on for almost everything they've done, all the products. And it's the exact opposite experience. You know, I don't want to ding Bill Gates, but it's the opposite of most people's experience with something like Windows. You know, they called it plug and pray. It would be, you know, people would waste so much time tinkering with their machines. They would get so frustrated. They became, you know, they became objects of repression and frustration.
Instead of objects of beauty and seen as liberation. And we're wondering if that can be the American layer, the American kind of way on top of a realm of roiling global competition that sets this country apart. Can we do it without Steve Jobs? Ken in Syracuse, New York. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for this opportunity. I just wanted to say that Steve Jobs was one of those very rare individuals that thought so far out of the box, and he never believed in obstacles. He made things happen, and not only that, was able to energize the people around him to do great things. And his impact is going to be felt for generations going forward, and this loss is going to have a rippling effect, I believe.
Well, look at that ripple. You and millions of others feeling that way today, Ken. Of course, I mean, not everybody's in on this. These are pricey products. You look at Apple stores, and it's an affluent crowd lined up there buying, you know, cut above pricey products. And yet, in that world, the enthusiasm and this sort of life-changing freedom that many people felt was really remarkable. Alex in Killington, Vermont. Alex, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I'd just like to say that I think everyone should go and see the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley. I think it's a great movie, and it really shows who Steve was. He was a really hard guy, and he was hard on his employees. And everyone I've talked to today about it was like, oh, Steve Jobs is a great guy. But if you worked for him, he was kind of a hard person to work for. He'd fire you if you did something wrong, or he would fire his employees. So I'd like to throw that side of Steve Jobs out there.
Alex, I appreciate it. Yeah. Yeah, we'll pick it straight up. I appreciate. I mean, here it is again. This driven man, and it could be rough working under him. Put that also in a kind of American business context. You know, does it take that, or is that just one way? Was it really that bad? I don't know, Nancy.
Well, you know, one of my colleagues at the school once said that entrepreneurs are individuals who relentlessly pursue opportunity without regard to obstacles and short, scarce resources currently controlled.
Or toes stepped on, necessarily.
Exactly. And if you look at, you know, people like Henry Ford or John Rockefeller, they were driven. They didn't suffer fools. They were harsh. They were hard. I don't think that is in any way the only path to success and to innovation. But it was Steve's path, and it's part of this bundle of contradictions that both Lev and Leander have alluded to, that really was this man. He doesn't fit a neat, nifty Pentaflex file folder well, because he was so many different gifts and attributes and weaknesses and foibles and frustrations.
Again, we've got to look at what it was that sent him right out of the company for a real time in the wilderness. Eric in Burlington, Massachusetts. Eric, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I didn't work there for. I worked there for 6 years. I was there when he came back
in Cupertino, California. Eric,
in Cupertino. That's
right.
Yeah. The company was searching around for a new OS, and somehow, you know, they looked at B and other companies, but somehow, you know, they arrived at Next and Next OS, and suddenly, you know, Next Apple became Next. It was, instead of Apple buying Next, sort of Next acquired Apple, but. Anyway, I was in the quad, which is in the
Apple campus. Complex there. Yes, the campus.
That's right. And the doors burst open across the quad, and he comes out, and there's nobody else around. He's walking across the quad, and I was not looking at him, but I was, you know, I knew he was there. And all of a sudden, I heard all this banging, and I look up, and he can't get in the door. And it was because he didn't have a badge yet.
So it's Steve Jobs banging on the door to get back into his own company to lead it to everything we've seen?
Yeah, he had just come back. He didn't have a badge yet, and he was just furious. You know, imagine not being able to get into your own company. So I ran across and just sort of, you know, said, oh, hi, Steve. You know, he looked at me sheepishly, and I quickly let him in, and, you know, he was off.
Hey, Eric, that was a great idea. That was a great idea, opening the door to Steve Jobs. What do you think? How will you remember the man, Eric?
Well, I thought about later. I thought, well, if it could have been funny to say, hey, you know, can I see some ID or something like that? You know, I knew he was.
Maybe not.
And I thought the better of it because, you know, he was mercurial. I mean, there were stories of him. If you got on an elevator as an engineer and couldn't describe in very concisely what value you added to the company, you might not have a job when you got off the elevator.
Wow.
He was so driven, and he expected everybody to be on.
Eric, you open our eyes, and I really appreciate it. We're talking about Steve Jobs in all his incredible complexity this hour. I mean, Nancy, there it is again. This man was driven, mercurially driven. There's Eric, who worked for him, afraid if you got off the elevator without having described in 30 seconds what you did, you might be done.
That was, you know, that was the fuel that gassed him, that drive, right, married to a bunch of different aspirations, including, I think, leading a revolution or helping foment a revolution. I think having power. I think it was less about money for Steve, always less about money, although, you know, he ended up a very wealthy man. Mm-hmm. But I think what's interesting about the drive and Eric's comment is a definition of leadership that David Foster Wallace, the American novelist, proffered a few years ago. He said that leaders are people who help us overcome our own frailties and weaknesses and fear and the limitations thereof, and get us to do harder, better, smarter things than we could get ourselves to do on our own. And a lot of that mercurial energy and that drive, I think, did exactly that at Apple. It helped successive groups of engineers do better, harder, smarter things than they might have done on their own.
Lev Grossman, why was he driven out when he was driven? He was chairman and he was driven out of the company. Why?
I think he hadn't learned all the lessons that he was, you know, he was yet to learn about management, about supply chains. You know, there were pieces of the puzzle that Jobs had not yet put together. And I think he didn't quite know how to channel his own towering control freakiness, his obsession with control, and having to run everything and everything having to go through him. That is not a management style that anybody else was able to make work, including Jobs at that point.
Leander, did he feel bad about it, Leander Caney, or was it just, hey, that's who I am and here we go?
I think he felt bad about it when he got driven out of the company.
Yeah.
He soon picked himself up and was back to his old ways at Next. You know, he's not the type to look back. He's never looked back at all. He mellowed with age, for sure, and he became a lot better manager and a lot better delegator while at Next. I don't think he's regretted the way that he treated people. And, of course, he has a terrible reputation as a taskmaster, as a bit of a user of people. He used people as tools. He saw them as a means to an end. He didn't, you know, there's not a lot of stories about Steve getting all warm and fuzzy at the company barbecue.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life and tremendous legacy of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, dead yesterday at 56, but so alive in that lifetime to the frontiers of innovation. With us today, Nancy Kane of the Harvard Business School, Lev Grossman of Time Magazine, Leander Caney, author of Inside Steve's Brain, editor and publisher at cultofmac.com. And we're going to hear a full 5 minutes of Steve Jobs at the end of this hour from a tremendous commencement speech, very revealing, a rare moment of self-revelation, where he talked about himself, his life, his illness, having been an orphan, and how to confront and address the world, at least the Steve Jobs way. Lots of response online here. Noreen says, Steve Jobs stole the lightning and gave it to the people. It used to be the province of governments to control and access the knowledge of the universe gained from computers. He brought it right down to the people. David says, Losing Steve Jobs is a lot like losing John Lennon. They both brought a lot of heart and soul to what they did, and like them, their legacy lives on through all of us. Hey, let's hold hands. But Corey says, I'm blown away with the coverage of this story. I heard one commentator say, if there is no heaven, when he gets there, Steve Jobs will create one. Another compared him to the cultural influence of John Lennon. Yes, we just heard it. Corey says, I see a combination of Harlan Sanders, what is it, Colonel Sanders, Kentucky Fried, and P.T. Barnum. Our hero worship is so screwed up in this country. Condolences to his family and friends. But the foundations of Western civilization will not crumble from his loss. What are you saying? You see that range, Nancy.
I think it's a range that's very appropriate to a figure that tapped into so many different aspects of how we think about our life and our economy and our possibility. You know, I don't think he's Shakespeare or Newton. I think he's a very, very important entrepreneur who is leaving a big, big footprint, possibly bigger than we even know, because just think about how when Steve Jobs started in the late 70s, mm-hmm. it was the computer revolution. Mm-hmm. Then it was the information revolution. Then we called it the digital revolution. Mm-hmm. And he, through persistence and lots of ups and downs, stayed somewhere near the mother lode of all those different transformations that now have become something much bigger than even he saw in 1976.
Pushing information all the way to the fore. Well, we're talking these days, I mean, there's a lot of physicists involved here too, about information as the very fabric of the universe.
Absolutely. And information in its ability then to become, you know, knowledge and understanding, possibly even wisdom, and to topple governments, right? To upset bankers outside of Wall Street, to do all kinds of things that we never knew it could do in a much more democratic form.
But making that manifest meant busting it out of those great big IBM sort of hulking behemoths that we knew before. Anthony in Rehoboth, Massachusetts is calling. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yes, sir.
I've often thought when something read something that provokes this line of thought about how much we've changed over the last 30, 40 years. And as you can tell, I'm a little older. And it often brings me back to a scene from a Woody Allen movie in 1969, where the Woody Allen character is being interviewed for a job in an office somewhere. And the interviewer asks him if he's ever had experience running a high-speed digital computer.
Okay.
And the Woody Allen character says, oh, yes, I have. And the interviewer asks, where? And he says, my aunt has one. And the audience cracks up at the thought because it's so preposterous.
Because they lived in those days in gigantic rooms, whole buildings holding a single computer.
Absolutely. And it was just so preposterous that it was like verbal slapstick. But that's what he brought us. 8 years later, Apple introduces the Apple II, mm-hmm. which is really a computer that your niece might own. And those are the kind of changes that he and the company he helped create have brought us. And I don't think we can overstate how much of an influence they've had and he's had.
Anthony, your perspective is precious. I'm really glad for that. Lev Grossman, I mean, the Apple II, that was the first computer I got my kids. And I saw them grow up in this Apple world. It made them see the world differently. They still do. They're complete enthusiasts of this, but it gave them a kind of a direct access. No sense of having to cut through a lot of clunk. Just here we are with the digital universe, Lev.
You know, one of the things that really interests me about what Jobs did is that he was as much a designer as he was a technologist, and he realized at some point that essentially design is more important than function. Form is more important than function. When he released the Apple II or the iPod, these were not devices that did things that no other device could do.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was the power that they had, you could access it. He realized that all the horsepower under the hood, you could have all the horsepower in the world under the hood, but if you didn't know how to use it, if you didn't feel like using it, if you didn't look good using it, the stuff was useless. And what he figured out was that design was important in that way. Because you know, even if your product did less, you know, technically, from an engineering point of view, if users could and would use it to do more, if they understood how to use it without a manual, then it was more powerful.
Making it kind of irresistible. Melanie in Boston, maybe on that stream. Melanie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, what do you think, Melanie?
Well, I think thank you for taking my call. First of all, I think it's a tragic loss. but being a lifetime Apple user and believer 100%, I'm also a designer and art director, and just wanted to say that he had such an impact that in whenever we would get you know, a job from anything in the from travel industry to fashion industry to hardware companies that might have wanted a website, inevitably they would say, "We want it to look like Apple. Check out the Apple website. That's what we want."
So what's the power in that? I mean, is design that powerful? Form over function? You just heard Lev Grossman say, you're a designer. Do you believe it? Is that what drove it?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all you, Melanie.
Oh, yeah, no, I do believe. I think that it's something about the intuitiveness of even how the design spoke to people, how it was clean and easy to read and easy to navigate, but yet classic and beautiful.
Melanie, I appreciate your call. Nancy Kane, I mean, look, there are limits here. It's not the end of hunger in the world. It's not the end of woe and despair. In the years that Apple grew, problems also grew in this country. It didn't, you know, it's not the end of inequality. It's not the end. At the same time, it was a source of such inspiration, pleasure, connectedness, as you say. And then there was this aspect that these things look like works of art.
You know, I'm so struck by what Melanie's topic sentence. I'm a user and I'm a believer. Now, how many titans die and people call into radio shows to say, "I'm a user and a believer"?
Yeah.
That tells us a lot. Yes. You know, again, the idea that there was an enormous hole in which all our excitement about engineering and computing power was creating by ignoring the fact that these are individuals that have to use them. And that power, that insight, right, that opportunity that Jobs kept on exploiting didn't just change, you know, the barriers around big companies like IBM, didn't just bite into Microsoft's market leadership and ultimately, you know, eat away at it. It also disrupted or creatively destroyed lots of other barriers. Think about music distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Think about book publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how the power of the design and its enormous appeal to consumers gave Jobs the power to say to publishers, "Here's what I want to charge for books."
Yeah.
Jeff Bezos, be damned. And
well,
here's what I'm going to do.
A couple of days ago.
Exactly. And here's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Right? So it was, you know, form over function. I think it's form and function, and 1 + 1 = 4, and what that did for a lot of different businesses, with Steve, in some sense, all the way up until August of this year, right, sitting in a unique and amazing kind of driver's seat. So let's not forget about the power that he ultimately wielded, much of it, you know, by means he did not anticipate or try and accumulate.
Do we sit and wait for, you know, the majesty of the universe to deliver another one of these? Here's Brit says online, "Only in America is it possible that an adopted baby whose biological father was an immigrant from Syria and Egypt can become such a transformational business leader, the likes of which the world has never seen." R.I.P. Steve Jobs. I mean, never seen or not, these are remarkable circumstances, a remarkable guy. You know, is this just something that the cosmos hands us, or are there more coming up?
No, it's not something the cosmos hands us. The lessons of Steve Jobs' life, his journey, are really important for America right now, and for poverty, and for inequality, and for the great American experiment.
Why, how? We've got a minute before he takes the
stage.
They are
lessons of persistence, of innovation, of, as he said, live foolish, live hungry, of following your dreams, of not giving up, and of working very, very, very hard. America needs to learn those lessons and relearn them right here, right now.
Lev Grossman, a winning strategy for the country buried in Steve Jobs' legacy?
Well, you know, if manufacturing goes overseas, you know, what is the expertise that remains in America? It's design. I think that, you know, as much as if we can't produce engineers at the rate of other countries, the thing we still produce is designers. That's something we need to remember, because it's becoming, as a country, our core competence.
Leander Caney, we've just got 10 seconds. Does it pull a plug on some confidence in Silicon Valley to see Jobs go, or do you feel plenty more?
You know, there's plenty more coming up. Mark Zuckerberg, you know, and a thousand other startups. So it's a great loss, but I'm confident that humankind will see his like again.
Leander Caney, Lev Grossman, Nancy Kane, I'm very grateful to all of you for being here today, the day after the passing of Steve Jobs. In a moment, a few important words, life lessons from the man himself, Steve Jobs. This is On Point. 2005, Steve Jobs delivered the commencement address to graduates of Stanford University. He spoke about his life's work and poignantly about his then recently diagnosed pancreatic cancer. The speech has been viewed nearly 5 million times on YouTube. Here is an excerpt of that address.
When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I've looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. About a year ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I had a scan at 7:30 in the morning, and it clearly showed a tumor on my pancreas. I didn't even know what a pancreas was. The doctors told me this was almost certainly a type of cancer that is incurable, and that I should expect to live no longer than 3 to 6 months. My doctor advised me to go home and get my affairs in order, which is doctor's code for prepare to die. It means to try and tell your kids everything you thought you'd have the next 10 years to tell them in just a few months. It means to make sure everything is buttoned up so that it will be as easy as possible for your family. It means to say your goodbyes. I live with that diagnosis all day. Later that evening, I had a biopsy where they stuck an endoscope down my throat, through my stomach and into my intestines, put a needle into my pancreas and got a few cells from the tumor. I was sedated, but my wife, who was there, told me that when they viewed the cells under a microscope, the doctor started crying because it turned out to be a very rare form of pancreatic cancer that is curable with surgery. I had the surgery, and thankfully, I'm fine now. This was the closest I've been to facing death, and I hope it's the closest I get for a few more decades. Having lived through it, I can now say this to you with a bit more certainty than when death was a useful but purely intellectual concept. No one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there. And yet, death is the destination we all share. No one has ever escaped it. And that is as it should be, because death is very likely the single best invention of life. It's life's change agent. It clears out the old to make way for the new. Right now, the new is you. But someday, not too long from now, you will gradually become the old and be cleared away. Sorry to be so dramatic, but it's quite true. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. When I was young, there was an amazing publication called the Whole Earth Catalog, which was one of the Bibles of my generation. It was created by a fellow named Stuart Brand, not far from here in Menlo Park, and he brought it to life with his poetic touch. This was in the late 60s, before personal computers and desktop publishing, so it was all made with typewriters, scissors, and Polaroid cameras. It was sort of like Google in paperback form 35 years before Google came along. It was idealistic, overflowing with neat tools and great notions. Stuart and his team put out several issues of the Whole Earth Catalog, And then, when it had run its course, they put out a final issue. It was the mid-1970s, and I was your age. On the back cover of their final issue was a photograph of an early morning country road, the kind you might find yourself hitchhiking on if you were so adventurous. Beneath it were the words, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." It was their farewell message as they signed off, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." And I have always wished that for myself. And now, as you graduate to begin anew, I wish that for you. Stay hungry, stay foolish. Thank you all very much.
Apple founder Steve Jobs speaking in 2005 to graduates at Stanford University. For a full transcript of that speech and to see a video of his address, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. Steve Jobs died yesterday at 56. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.